welcome to this week's edition of Two Men in the Middle. We're two men in the middle of the country opine about politics from the center left and center right. I'm Brandon Kinnig.
I'm Craig Huey, and I'm ready to opine tonight, Brandon.
There's plenty to opine about. So let's hand it off to you to discuss Giuliani's bizarre, rabid press conference, which I did not see this live. I'm only going based off of articles and post analysis. So give us the 411 on this.
This is one of the benefits of working from home is I do get to turn the TV on and watch all these things live and in person and start harassing people. Are you watching this? Are you watching this? So this was a press conference that I first became aware of when Trump tweeted out, hey, big press conference this morning. So I think that that's important because this was promoted by the president. This wasn't Giuliani and Powell and this group going off on their own. They completely had the endorsement and the promotion of the president of the United States behind them for this event. So they have a press conference, and the first half starts off, I think, kind of very generic for Rudy Giuliani. He's going over the same type of allegations that he's already presented in Michigan and Pennsylvania and places like that, things that the court has already bounced out. I have hundreds of affidavits of people that saw things that look suspicious, of things that they said were just directly fraud. And he kind of replays some of those hits. Now, to my knowledge, most of that stuff has already been seen by a court in various states, and most of that has just been dismissed.
And I'm curious, again, these are all just allegations. There's usually no evidence. The couple of instances where there were individual examples given, most of those have already been debunked.
I
don't know, did he give any of those already debunked instances, examples again?
He, that's all this was. This is why this was confusing, because I joined this press conference hoping we would get some new information.
But that really, was a mistake. Yeah.
It was just a replay of those hits. So what was also confusing about this is 2 hours before this press conference, they had dropped their lawsuit in Michigan.
Right.
And for like the first 15 minutes of it, it was about Michigan and their legal action there. So the whole thing, Giuliani's whole presentation was just confusing, rambling. And I thought it was just a rehash of just of what was already been said. So I was ready for this to be boring, but that's when Sidney Powell came to the microphone. So my understanding is she is an ex-federal prosecutor, and she was also the lawyer for Michael Flynn, is my understanding.
Okay.
So she is a legitimate lawyer. She is the one who introduces now this massive conspiracy theory. She is the one who basically says this is a global conspiracy that includes George Soros, the Clinton Foundation, funded by, she mentioned Hugo Chavez and Venezuela. This is a communist-centered plot that Venezuela, Cuba, China, Soros, and the Clinton Foundation have funded, and that the Democrats across the board, but especially in these big cities where they have a concentration of Democrats, that they have all executed this plot to steal this election from Donald Trump. That was the kind of new today.
So that was the new argument, which was presented not by Giuliani, who you would expect to make some type of asinine, conspiracy-laden accusation, but by a prosecutor who's fairly experienced and is apparently, you know, allowing her reputation to be shredded by, you know, agreeing to this. I can't believe that a former... But I mean, Giuliani is a former prosecutor as well. But I mean, anybody else would, you know, go along with this.
This is where, it is hard to, it is hard after watching that to understand who put that together.
Yeah.
What were they actually trying to communicate?
And let's also put this in the context of most of the big firms and big time attorneys that the campaign was using for a lot of these state by state cases either quit or withdrew their cases because they didn't want to continue to be tied to this just escapade, because there's just no legal authority there. And they were getting just incinerated in court by these judges over and over again. So who you're left with is Giuliani and then apparently this former federal prosecutor, Michael Flynn defender. I mean, how do you even speak to that? I mean, what do you say?
Yeah. I mean, she was the one who really kind of blew it out of the water. I mean, we all kind of expected Giuliani just to do what he does. I'm interested.
Did they take questions after this or not?
They did. There were some questions there. The questions were mostly of them just attacking the media to why they won't go out and investigate this story. So I kind of knew what Giuliani was going to bring to the table. I didn't know they were going to go full in with the global conspiracy.
Yeah.
I didn't know we were at that stage yet. Because for me, that's when you like have ripped the rip cord and you're throwing, this is the ultimate Hail Mary. This is the ultimate last stand. And when you're bringing out Soros, the Clinton Foundation, to me, this says you're out of runway and you're
it's a sign of desperation. You have nothing left because that doesn't go anywhere in court.
No. And their plea was, this is our opening salvo, kind of hang with us. We're going to explain this and we're going to show you evidence as we go. I don't think anybody after today believes that there's any real credible evidence coming about this global conspiracy to steal the election from Donald Trump.
No. And this has been the trajectory of their argument this entire time, right? They started with edge cases, for example, in Pennsylvania saying, you know, we don't want ballots counted. We want to repeal the directive that allowed the state to count ballots that were postmarked by election day, but received, you know, 3 days after. So when that didn't work out for them, they then amended their lawsuit and it got crazier to the point where this past week it was, we think the entire election in the state of Pennsylvania should be invalidated, to which the federal judge responded, so you want me to disenfranchise 6.8 million voters in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania based on speculation and hearsay.
So when that failed, when the judge finally told them, if this is your core argument, there's no way.
Yeah.
You have no case here and I'm not going to do that. And I think the tone of that was, there's no judge that's going to do that. It feels like that's when they brought in this Sidney Powell and said, okay, we have to make a different play. We're going to pivot now to this wide global conspiracy, and let's just bring in all the hits, Soros, the Clintons. If we're going to go, we might as well go big. And they kind of widened out their approach to now it's, okay, we can't prove all of this in court, but there's no way not to disprove the fact that this global cabal stole the election from Donald Trump. And I guess that's the strategy.
Well, and it's no longer a legal play, right? Because if you're going with that claim, you have basically ceded any legal ground that there would have been. And you are now just speaking to the base. And so your whole idea is to keep up the narrative that the election was fraudulent, that it was stolen, and to now, you know, create the, you know, conspiracy from point A to point Z on why and how, you know. And so you bring in, you know, the boogeyman of the right, you bring in George Soros, bring in, you know, South American leftist dictators and try to say, oh, they're all together. It's all a big conspiracy.
I mean, she went all the way back to Hugo Chavez. I mean, why do you have to go back that far?
Yeah, he's not in power anymore. I mean, he's this, you know, he cares this much that he wants to be involved
overturning Trump's election. So to me, the real takeaway from that was, obviously there is nothing to the legal angle that Giuliani's tried to play. I think we always suspected it with the court rulings and now this just let the cat out of the bag.
But now this does seem to speak to the fact that they, while they have discarded the legal angle, they are pursuing and overturning the election and the Electoral College. Because if they are speaking to the base, they may also be speaking to far right lawmakers in some of these states who they are now approaching saying, we want you to say that the election produced too many questions, there's too many irregularities, and because of that, we need you to appoint your own electors that will vote for Donald Trump and overturn the results.
And I think you're bringing the end game into focus now. It feels like that was always going to be the play, knowing that very, very few of these
lawsuits were going to succeed. Yeah.
These weren't going to go anywhere. But what comes into play now is it's this vast global conspiracy that there's no possible way you could ever definitively prove that this didn't happen because it's so outrageous. So And it's geared to play right at the hardest part of Trump's base. So it feels like this was a two-part strategy. First, we're going to do the legal stuff where we're going to show evidence through affidavits and other forms of evidence, but mostly through affidavits of people who were there that say, I saw this cheating happen. So they're presenting that as their core block of evidence, which they...
Well, that quickly fell apart, very quickly.
And they knew that would fall apart, but now the pivot is to what they're really going to run forward with, which is this conspiracy.
So, and this, there is no way, likely no way, that this succeeds in any way, shape, or form. For any state lawmakers in any of these swing states to agree to this, it would be the kiss of death for them politically, and they know that. And all of these states that Trump is disputing, the Republican leadership and the state legislatures of all these states have already come out and said that they're not going to overturn the result. That's just not going to happen. They're not going to get involved. The question is, now that Trump has invited Pennsylvania state Republican leadership to the White House tomorrow, what does he say to them? And does he convince them to have an about face?
So I want to unpack what you just said. The president of the United States, well, within the last 24 hours, he called two election canvassers for Wayne County.
Where Detroit is in Michigan.
Correct. Yep. These are the two folks that first were not going to vote to certify the election. They got a bunch of shit for it. And then they went along and certified.
And then they apparently recanted afterwards, which has no impact because it's already been certified.
And Trump called them. And the woman said that he called her just to check in on her to make sure everything was okay. Did she feel safe? Why is the president of the United States calling two local county officials about certifying election results?
Yeah, I mean, that is unprecedented.
Is that
should
legal?
Not be going on. I don't know of anything where it's illegal, but it's highly, highly
inappropriate.
Inappropriate. It's unprecedented. I mean, it's out of the bounds of norms, right?
Yeah.
That we expect. I mean, calling state lawmakers to the White House to ask them to overturn the result in their state, I don't think that's ever been done in the history of our republic.
So
that is very scary. And if you want to talk about dangerous, that is absolutely dangerous. I mean, to for the sitting president of the United States to pressure state lawmakers to go against the will of the people to keep him in power. I there's nothing that compares to that.
I could play along with all of this up to today. I could side with the people and I could see the logic in the argument. I would disagree with it, but at least I could see the logic of, hey, he got more votes than anybody except Joe Biden who won ever running for president.
Yeah.
He did better than everybody thought. It's okay if we play this out a little bit. We're not doing harm. You know, yes, everybody understands who and what Trump is, and let this play out after Thanksgiving. This will all wash out and we'll go about our business. I don't think that's the plan from the president. And I think today, this press conference, and then by him inviting state officials to the White House, I think his end game comes into play that he's going to try to get the Electoral College to vote him instead of Biden. I think evidence is mounting. He's actively trying to execute that plan.
He is. Now he's up against the clock, right? Because these states start certifying their results pretty quickly. And once the results are certified, pretty much the legislature is locked in. You cannot, you know, change electors, change voting. So that clock is ticking. Tomorrow, Georgia actually sort of has to certify its results, I think by 12 noon, if I have that right.
And I think so. They would certify for Biden in there.
Yeah.
They're good to go.
And they've conducted this manual hand recount, which we should have the final numbers back tomorrow. And this is one of the few cases, and I want to give as much praise as possible to the Georgia Secretary of State, because he has been by the books and has, you know, and he has just been inundated with an onslaught of pressure and threats from Trump supporters just for doing his job and counting every vote. You know, and he has started to push back. And, you know, earlier this week, it's from Brad Rappensberger, I believe. We learned that Lindsey Graham had called him, asking him about, you know, invalidating votes from...
And what do you think of Lindsey's defenses? Well, I didn't ask that. I just asked him
I don't buy that for a second. No.
Not for one second.
And again, highly inappropriate, highly unethical, and none of Lindsey Graham's business. He doesn't even sit on the elections committee in the Senate. So this is not his purview, and he's completely out of bounds involving himself.
how many, I heard somebody say this today and it got me thinking, okay, so how many people would it actually take to flip a state? And I guess where I'm going with this is there's this theme that our democracy right now seems to be hanging by a thread.
Yeah.
And it is actively under assault by the executive branch. I think there's some truth to that. Some of that's hyperbole and overblown, but there's some baseline truths to that. If that is the case, how many people have to play along in a state for it to flip its election results? And it seems like not many. It seems like if a handful of people in one of these states don't give a shit about the truth, their reputation, or the country.
Are you talking about from the standpoint of the legislature, like the state legislature getting involved?
If we just walked through it, okay, well, there's at the county level. They could not certify the results.
With the canvassers, yeah.
That's a level. Then you go up a level. The attorney general, I think, has to. Maybe they wouldn't do it. Then there's another level where the state has to appoint electors that have to.
That's a good point. There are these layers and these points where everything gets verified. And it all hinges upon, you know, I think people acting in ethical capacities and according to their duty to, you know, perform their roles. And if they're unwilling to do so, Wayne County was a good example, that deadlock 2-2, yeah. You know, it shows how, you know, I think fragile our democracy is. And there's been some talk about this, right? That maybe we need to revisit laws that bind, you know, some of these, they're not, I was going to say elected officials. They're not elected officials. Many of them are
these
appointed officials to upholding their duty and to following through with the will of the people via the election results. Because apparently it seems like so much of this that we've taken for granted, they're not laws, they're norms.
Yeah.
And those norms can be broken with the wrong people.
It really shows you too how much this whole process of electing a president comes down to somebody conceding.
Yeah.
And when that doesn't happen, how ugly and how messy it gets.
And that's where we're at now. And I can't believe we're, you know, 2 weeks after Election Day with, you know, no concession, and a president and his administration who continue to operate in this reality that they are going to continue to be in office.
And they seem to be expanding what they're willing to attempt to do to stay in office.
Yeah.
I mean, their path isn't narrowing. It seems like they're throwing more stuff into the hopper to see if a path opens up in some way.
Well, that's what's crazy. There's been nothing that has opened their path. Like there's been nothing that has provided them the evidence they need. On the contrary, the more we learn, the more we realize how there's no there. There's nothing. So again, desperate Hail Mary pass to circumvent the will of the people via state legislature. But again, I cannot imagine any state lawmakers willing to do that, because that puts them in a unique position in American history, and that changes the game for the elections. I mean, there's already people saying that if their state lawmakers did this in Wisconsin or Michigan, that they would initiate recall petitions. I mean, so there's a flood of electoral consequences that come from that. But unfortunately, there is no criminal or civil consequences. I mean, there is this provision that the legislatures can do this, but it's not something that's been done. And to do it on the whim of a president who just doesn't want to concede power is asinine.
Today was another day that I felt kind of disappointed in the United States.
Yeah.
That this
is what we've come down to.
This is what it is.
And think about the rest of the world. I mean, they're watching this and like, you guys can't get your act together. I mean,
we would be making fun of this constantly.
This is banana republic type stuff.
It's just ridiculous. And I keep waiting for the adults in the room to step up and say, we're done. Okay, kids, we've had enough of that. We're not talking about this shit anymore. We are going to move forward. And I keep hoping that over the next couple of days that will happen, but I think I'm setting myself up for that. What does it say about the country? Or maybe what does this say about us when I'm thinking through five or six instances in the last 6 years where we've said Trump's done, that's it. The country will not tolerate that. That's a bridge too far. We can go back to starting his candidacy with Mexico sends rapist here. We can go to grab him by the, we could just go on and on and on. Have we, every time I think that's it, we've towed the bottom. It can't get any worse and the fever's going to break and people, this is their exit. We can't go on like this. This is too outrageous. And it just never happens. Is that ever going to happen? Am I just thinking back to a nostalgic era that I just need to get over and this is just what it's going to be?
Well, it feels that way because we have, continually crashed through every norm that exists. I mean, there's really very few that haven't been just obliterated at this point. And it feels like we've opened the floodgates for somebody in the future to do exactly what Trump has done and to get away with it. And that's what's sad. Norms are good in so far that you have, if they're tested, that there's pushback, that there's consequences, that you have lawmakers that stand up and say, you know, we're not going to stand for this. We haven't had that. I mean, if you go back, I mean, you know, what Nixon did seems quaint by comparison to Trump.
It really does.
But, you know, Nixon resigned because he knew what was coming. He knew that the Republicans in the Senate were, you know, consolidating in opposition against him and bringing up articles of impeachment. And that would not happen today. And so we're in this place that's just so dark because we have a whole party that cowers in fear of Trump and his base and nobody who's willing to stand up to them because they, for whatever reason, see them as a more permanent fixture in American politics and they do not want to lose their support and votes.
Brandon, what killed shame in our culture? Why is it that people, especially people in power, don't seem to be embarrassed by their behavior, don't seem to feel shame over blatantly just lying and presenting misinformation?
Lying, hypocrisy.
Have no sense of pride in their work or what they do and are willing to go out and just absolutely make an ass of themselves for somebody who could really care less about them. What is it? When did that get sucked out of politicians?
That's a good question. I've been struggling to figure that out. I mean, I can point to the rise of Trump and where that really accelerated, but I can't pinpoint to a specific period where that you started to see that in full view. I mean, the only thing I can point to is that Trump made that acceptable. And so then others started following and realized that if he could get away with it, they could as well. And so it became, basically a effect where you had a shepherd leading the sheep. And now we're where we're at. But I don't know. It's weird because this wasn't always the case. You can go back to the 90s. You can go back to the early 2000s where none of this would have been acceptable, where you had politicians who had to resign or leave office for much less offensive conduct and behavior. And again, you look back and it seems quaint. Like it's like, oh, you know, gosh, the good old days when there was shame and people apologize, acknowledge they had done wrong and they took responsibility for their actions. Now they don't. They refuse to acknowledge any reality that contradicts what they're pushing.
You've hung around a lot of politicians. Is this just as simple as you're modeling successful behavior? Hey, that's the president. That's the leader of our party. That's the guy who won when nobody thought he could. The easiest path forward is simply to model what that guy does. Is it as simple as that? Is it if Trump never existed and Jeb Bush would have gotten the nomination or somebody, none of this would have happened? Is it just as simple as that guy won, he's the leader of our party, the simplest and path of least resistance is just model what he does?
I mean, I don't think so. I think it's not as simple as just modeling his behavior. I do really think it's about fear that plays into it. They believe that Trump's base has a firm hold on the electorate, and if they go against him, they will be primary and they will lose.
And they also believe that base is expanding now.
Yes. So think about Georgia, right? So the two incumbent senators from Georgia who face election in January, they came out and blasted their own Secretary of State, a member of their own party, saying that he wasn't transparent, that he conducted an election that was fraudulent based on no proof. Why? Trump called them into the White House and said, if you don't do this, if you don't go out there publicly and criticize the Secretary of State, then you won't have my support in January. I will not endorse you. And that was enough to scare them, because they know that without Trump's support and his base showing up in January, they won't win.
I thought this would be done by now, because Trump is motivated by avoiding embarrassment.
Yeah.
And especially avoiding embarrassment on TV.
Yeah.
I think there's nothing worse for Trump to watch somebody representing him or himself in a bad TV moment. That seems to be like the ultimate kick in the nuts to President Trump. So I thought this would die out, that the Rudy Giuliani angle of this would die out after the four seasons debacle.
Right.
I mean, that was so ridiculous.
It was so amateurish, so...
And so widely
satiric.
Made fun of.
Yes.
I thought, that's going to penetrate Trump's shell, and he's going to see people are laughing at you. They're
you
making
should have been
fun.
Embarrassed by
this
that,
is
yeah.
embarrassing. Then you fast forward to today. And again, hey, I'm an old dude like Giuliani. I get it. You want to throw some dye in your hair before you get on TV. Totally understandable. But halfway through this press conference, he starts sweating hair dye down his face.
Oh, did he?
Did you see any of this on Twitter?
That.
It's literally running down his face. It's just embarrassing. I thought that, maybe the imagery that Rudy's putting out is so off-putting and is so embarrassing that would cause Trump to pump the brakes on this. Apparently, we haven't towed the bottom yet, too, for Trump on what he's comfortable with people going out and saying in his name and kind of in his defense.
Right.
And I keep thinking we would hit that wall. That's just dumbness on my part. That wall doesn't exist.
No, like you said, there's no shame, but apparently there's no embarrassment either. I mean, and I think, again, it reflects the point that Trump realizes he's boxed in. And so he doesn't care about embarrassment anymore. It's about holding on to power, and anything he can do to parlay holding on to power, at the very least, convince enough of his supporters that this was stolen from him so he can retain their support and influence for whatever he does post White House.
So states start certifying election results. I believe it's the 8th through the 12th is when states start that.
Well, I mean, states have, I mean, they're already starting.
That's true. That can't be right. Maybe they have to, everything has to be done by the 8th, but then there's a...
I think so, because there's many states that certify next week. There's a few that certify the following week. So there is, I forget when the last state certified by, but it's by early December.
I think I heard they all have to be in by December 8th, but there's some, of course, appeals process that you can extend it out to the absolute date is the 12th, and then December 14th, the Electoral College meets and votes.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that can all be done by Zoom. You just zoom in. Hey, we're the group from California.
It should be,
and we're voting for this. And it seems like a fairly straightforward process.
Right.
But to your point, if Trump's going to make a move, it has to be before they certify.
Yes.
Because if you start challenging a certified election, now we are definitely in uncharted territory.
Yeah, now you're in territory where you're definitely trying to overturn election results. Certified results are, basically where the state has said that we have reviewed these are accurate, this has been a valid election. You no longer have the same legal ground at all. And it takes away whatever credibility you have to go after and say, these results haven't been vetted. So that's where Trump finds himself, because these certifications are happening. Georgia's happening tomorrow, and that's not been delayed. Now, the Trump team has tried to delay certification in many states, and I think that's part of the play they're doing with bringing the Michigan lawmakers to the White House tomorrow, is to try to do that in Michigan, because I think Michigan doesn't certify until next week. again, it, you know, this process is very formalized in terms of deadline certification followed by Electoral College meeting. And then after that, after the certification happens, you don't have the ability to really get the state legislatures involved to overturn. So you're timed. And I think Pennsylvania certifies next Wednesday.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. In Nevada and Arizona, they certify, I think, early next week too.
Yeah.
To your point, this is done next week.
It is.
Once these things start, and I would be stunned if after a visit to the White House, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, if they do something funky in the Electoral College.
I don't see that happening.
And I don't know if that would stand either. The Supreme Court would certainly have something to say about that.
Well, and so you have to factor in, this is why this is a Hail Mary from Trump too, even if somehow they were to get enough legislators to do it by a majority, you know, in those state houses, because they're Republican controlled, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Nevada, Nevada has a Democratic legislature, so that doesn't enter in. But Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania have Democratic governors, and they can veto action by the legislature to appoint their own electors. So they would have to get like a 2/3 majority to be able to override the gubernatorial veto. And so that's why this isn't going to happen either.
And somebody posted like the language in the Constitution that says, you know, when would it be acceptable for the Electoral College not to vote for the person who won the state by vote? And like a lot of things in the Constitution, it's vague and it lays out some general guidelines, but it doesn't really say. But isn't too that if Michigan somehow said, we are not voting, our Electoral College voters are not going to vote for Joe Biden, wouldn't they have to defend why? I think they would have to say,
I think they would. I don't know if they're legally bound, but I mean, they would issue a decision. I mean, this would be an action that would come from the legislature, and it would have to have reasoning behind it. I mean, in context, yeah. I mean, you can't just say we're just going to do this on our own volition.
That Joe Biden is an existential threat to the United States.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be comical? The Trump administration arguing that the 47-year veteran of Washington is some existential threat to the democracy of the United States.
Well, you know what's also comical is the fact that Biden won all of these key swing states by a larger margin together than Trump won them by in 2016. Yes. So it's ridiculous, the notion that, you know, we're going to overturn the results because they're fraudulent. Well, we're talking about larger margins here than 2016. And that election, there was no concern about fraud.
Not one. And Trump overperformed in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
The city, he wants everything thrown out. There's evidence that he did better than he did in 2016.
Right. And the key for Biden's win in Pennsylvania was because even though Trump did slightly better in Philly, Biden did massively better than Hillary in the suburbs, the inner ring suburbs outside Philly.
I think to agree with Giuliani, you basically have to agree all mail-in voting is fraud on its face and Democrats are all corrupt.
Well, and you have to agree that the fact that there may be a few, because I mean, even if you took at face value, the couple of examples that they've pointed to are false, but even if they were true, they wouldn't overturn the results or not enough to change the outcome. But you would have to then follow the illogical claim that because we found this, we're just going to assume that there are tens of thousands, if not more, fraudulent votes, and we need to overturn and disenfranchise everybody.
This is my favorite argument. And I've never known a politician to do this before Trump, and now I notice all of them do it. You mentioned like that, and you're like, well, Craig, it's a logical pattern. You know it as well as I do. You can see it too, can't you? Of course you can.
Yeah.
It's logical that if it happened this five times, it happened 500,000 times. And I think that's another core weaving into.
The mindset, yeah.
They are weaponizing the small portion of fraud and irregularities that happen in every election.
part of that is, so if you ask them about this, well, what's your proof? Do you know? And they're like, well, no, but do you know that there wasn't fraud?
True.
Like somehow just, you know, and so they turn it back and like, that's not the way it works. The burden of proof is on them to prove that there was fraud in an election where there's no indication of it. But their argument seems to be, well, unless you can prove exactly that every vote was counted legitimately, then there, you know, we're going to go with the assumption there was fraud.
And if there's six out of 600,000, then you have to throw the whole batch out.
Yeah. So it all has to be invalidated, which means the whole election is invalidated. Everybody's vote is disenfranchised.
This topic, we've spent like 36 minutes on this topic, and it's just too stupid to talk about.
It's infuriating. Yeah.
It's just, if this is what America is moving forward, good God help us all.
And the irony is that as this goes on, there are states like California and New York that are still, you know, counting votes, you know, because of their large states. And so, you know, Biden pretty soon is going to be at over 80 million votes cast. So while Trump has 72, 73, which is much more than he had last time around, I think 10 million more, you also have Biden and has garnered more votes than any president in history, and is well over 51% of the total vote now. So if you look at the percentage split, you're going to have, when all the dust settles, over 6 million vote difference between Biden and Trump, 51% to 47%. I mean, that isn't Bush v. Gore margins.
And in modern elections, this is a blowout.
This is
a landslide.
And let's put it in context. For a challenger going after an incumbent, it's the largest win since FDR took on Hoover in 1932.
Yeah.
I mean, but you don't achieve these margins against incumbents normally.
I feel like I've asked you this question 1,000 times. I really just ask it just to speak it out loud. What is the path out of this? How does this end? Or is that really just all up to Donald Trump? And we really have no control over it.
I mean, it is going to end. I do believe, I don't think he will be successful in this insane attempt to circumvent the will of the people through state legislatures. So whether he wants to acknowledge it or not, this process will go through and it will end. And he will be on the receiving end of being the loser incumbent who has to vacate the White House. Now, he may never acknowledge that. He may never, but he will leave. And I could see a scenario where he would leave, you know, for Mar-a-Lago around Christmas, just not acknowledge what happened. He's not going to return for the inauguration. I would be shocked, because that would be an acceptance of defeat and an acknowledgement of defeat. And he doesn't do that.
No. So 2 days or so, well, after the Fox called on Friday or Saturday after the election, was when most major media outlets had called the election for Biden and said Biden was president-elect. After a day or two after that, when it started to settle in with folks, said, hey, Biden won this election, you had a pundit class, and these are your Hugh Hewitts, your Lou Dobbs, your Jesse Waters, your hardcores. They started immediately pivoting to Trump's amazing four-year legacy. And they immediately started to kind of position out, hey, Trump may have lost, but his legacy of accomplishment for a one-term presidency outshadows most everything that even two-term presidents has done.
Right.
So, okay, makes sense. You've got your pundit class, and if that's the way you want to spin it, I can roll with that. Hugh Hewitt is the first one that I've noticed who's kind of pulled that back a little bit and said, I'm going to refrain defining what President Trump's legacy is until we get out of this transition period. Because again, but I think what he's saying is he could do some serious damage to himself in this last 62 days. I think what he was saying was, hey, I was willing to go out and carry some water for you about, hey, you may have lost, but hey, this myth that you did more, I'm willing to help you with that, but you're going to have to show me I'm not following you down the George Soros crazy town hole. So I think there are some people that are beginning to start kind of maybe framing this argument around a legacy argument that maybe that gravitates with Trump.
Well, I hope so. Maybe that would be the final thing that would cause Trump to start to pull back and consider what he's doing, because he does care about what people think about him. And he is very hypersensitive to, you know, what especially those on the right, like his reputation. So if he starts feeling the heat and feeling that his legacy is in trouble, knowing that he could still have a lot of influence in the party and picking the next nominee, if it's not him, continuing his movement in many ways in media empire, then he should give serious thought to rethinking what he's done. Another thing we didn't even discuss was the fact that he fired the director of election security, the guy who came out and said this was the most secure election in history, and he just fired him and said, I'm firing him because I don't like what he said.
Yeah. He's contradicting me. He's gone.
And there is so much damage Trump can still do between now and Inauguration Day. Another good example was that he, actually speculated launching an attack on Iran.
I saw that.
And his advisors had to talk him out of that, which would be catastrophic. So, I mean, if he... And I think from Trump's perspective, I think he has no qualms about trying to put Biden in a quandary and leave him with a mess.
Well, he's going to run again in 2024. I don't think he's worried about his legacy because he doesn't think his legacy as president is done.
Yeah.
I think I could absolutely see him putting Biden in the worst possible spot he could be in, thinking, I'm going to strengthen my hand already for 2024. I think that's completely within reason. To ask the question that would he do that? And I think it's yes. God, we got to talk about something different. I'm just getting depressed thinking about
this.
This
is like the most depressed podcast we've done in so long.
It's just brutal. Right when you think the fever's going to break,
we're going
to
round.
It's just, you see this and it's just like, you've got to be shitting me. This is where we're standing at today. And then when it's not this news, it's the fact that 250,000 Americans have died of the coronavirus. Yeah. 175,000 new cases a day. We're back up to 1,500 deaths.
And we have a president who's completely checked out of that.
Does not seem to care.
Doesn't care.
And we should be celebrating the vaccines. The dam is kind of broken open, and there's like four of them now in contention.
Yeah, there's four. There's two that are going to be available on an emergency use basis to physicians, frontline healthcare workers, and first responders before the end of the year. You have Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine. Pfizer, initially, they said it was 90% effective. The most recent data shows that it's over 95% effective. Moderna's 94%. Pfizer's a little bit, that vaccine's a little bit more sensitive because it has to be stored at sub-zero temperatures, and there's only so many facilities that can do that. But the Moderna vaccine can be stored at room temperature, so we'll be able to get it at your CVS and your Walgreens. But this is phenomenal news. We have, two more vaccines that are just close behind that are still in phase three trials, but we're going to have Moderna and Pfizer approved for emergency use before the end of December. They will start rolling out. I know for a fact that there are hospitals like the VA hospital in Topeka that are already organizing distribution committees internally to figure out how to get it to their patients as well as their frontline workers because they're expecting shipments before the end of December. So we are on the path to returning to normal. And there's a scenario where if everything goes well, particularly because we have two vaccines now, I would have said before we had the news on Moderna, if we were just talking about one, we could see us not going back to normal till late spring. But I think now you could have a scenario where we return to almost normal by early spring because we have two vaccines, productions and manufacturing being scaled for both. So the more vaccines, the quicker we're going to get out of this.
I'm going to have to do some research on what Operation Warp Speed is and what it actually did. Because the first thing is we are not the only country that is at this phase of right at the doorstep of having a vaccine.
We are not. There's ready. Also the AstraZeneca vaccine, which was developed with the conjunction of the University of Oxford, which is also pretty far along. They're not out of phase three yet, but it's also been proven. And there's a handful of others. So, everything is looking good. We're in a great scenario. And also, incidentally, the Pfizer vaccine was not part of the Warp Speed program. They did not get that influx of funding.
Yeah. I think they came out and tried to clean that up a little bit because I think Trump jumped all over them when they came out and said that.
Oh, okay. Well, Trump jumped all over them. I remember initially because he claimed that, this was political and they were waiting until after the election to release it.
But here's what I don't get. Pfizer is one of the most profitable companies on the planet. why did they have to have billions of dollars from the government to create this virus? They're sitting on billions of dollars. Yeah.
They do have a lot. Now, did they? So are they part of Warp Speed? Then I thought they weren't. When you said they cleaned it up, do you mean that they...
They came out and said that they... Well, I don't think they took some of the initial money.
Okay.
They were part of it because they basically went to the meetings, they followed the protocols, and they were part of the regulatory parts of
Warp Speed.
But they
didn't get the influx of funding, government funding. Then?
I don't believe they took that.
Because that was the argument that they were making that they didn't even
But isn't
take.
It, too, isn't it, I'm helping you with the funding to get started, but then with like Pfizer and some of these, haven't we pre-ordered like $2 billion yeah. worth of this vaccine?
Oh, yeah.
So here's what I don't understand. You take a company like a Pfizer that is a global pharmaceutical monster
right.
that makes
Behemoth.
Billions of dollars. And you gave them billions of dollars investment free from the government, and then you pre-ordered $2 billion worth of the product. What did that do? These companies didn't have to be goaded into creating a vaccine. If you're a pharmaceutical company, a global pandemic represents a market opportunity, a once in a century market opportunity.
Right.
They would have invested anything. Why did we have to sink billions of dollars into that?
Well, I can understand when it comes to some of the smaller players like Moderna, some of these others that are not large or smaller biotech firms. So they don't have that longevity and the funding, the cash flows that the big of pharma has. But yeah, with Pfizer, I mean, there's no question. I mean, they wouldn't need any assistance to what they did.
Maybe I'm just being pissy because I'm not trying to shit on getting a vaccine. That's great news. We need to get as many of these out to as many people as we can. But I'm just tired of hearing about Operation Warp Speed and nobody giving a single concrete detail of what it is, what it did, and why it helped get the vaccine faster.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It doesn't appear to be unique to the United States. People are comparing this to the moonshot. No, it's very different. We were the only people that went to the moon. Mm-hmm. Everybody did this. So I'm not trying to crap on, you know, getting this virus out, and I'm not trying to downplay. I'm sure the Trump administration cut all kinds of regulatory paths to get here.
Right.
But the market would have taken care of this. You don't have to goad a company like a Pfizer to take advantage of billions and billions of dollar opportunities to develop a drug, which is what the company does. So,
I mean, the only thing I can think of is that the funding streams were used to incentivize them to move even more quickly than they normally would, kind of cut through the bureaucracy. So there's probably aspects of that funding can make a difference.
I understand how cynical that sounds. On a week that we get great news about viruses, I'm shitting on the program that helped create those. And maybe that's a byproduct of 2020. I don't believe anybody anymore. I don't believe anything anybody says.
But see, generally, the problem with vaccines has always been that generally haven't been that many players in the market because vaccines are not as profitable as drugs are.
This would be a great explanation.
Because there's a lot of R&D that goes into them. And so the cost is enormous to bring them into market, much more so than standard drugs because they're much more highly regulated because for variety of reasons. And, vaccines just don't have long-term profitability like other drugs do. So there aren't as many players. I had read that if you go back in the last 50 years, number of players like in the flu vaccine space has gone from a couple hundred to now less than a dozen. I think
just,
maybe less
just
than five.
Less profitable.
Yeah, it's less profitable. So there's probably some argument to make that government needs to be involved in that incentivizing. And I think long term, obviously, we have the chance now with the new president to do this, but we really need to have a long term strategy and plan in place to fund infectious disease research to get funding for it. A good example was when SARS-1 came out back in 2003. There was a vaccine being worked and that money evaporated when SARS kind of just evaporated. And there were scientists that said, no, we basically have a vaccine that's a cure. And they're like, sorry, no more money. Well, the problem is that vaccine, because that's the original SARS virus, very similar to this virus, also coronavirus. If that vaccine had been allowed to go to be funded to fruition, we could have dusted that off the shelf and mm-hmm. used that and been further ahead than we are now.
And maybe that's what my complaint is. You just quickly said, hey, there's some reasons why companies might need startup money to fund vaccine research.
Right.
It's not as profitable. People don't get into it much.
And if it looks like any type of disease or virus is starting to get under control, the funding stream for any vaccine that's in development just dries up. And so we don't see it, even though we know from history, right, that these viruses can come back. So even though the first SARS was contained, you can have variants of it that pop up later or come back. Or you could be in a situation now where we have another SARS COVID virus that is problematic. So that's why the long-term funding of this research and vaccine development is key. So it's not just based on short-term objectives and, you know, and the short-term outlook and patterns of whether or not it's a virus is spreading or not spreading. It needs to be beyond that.
In literally 3 minutes, you made me feel better about the Operation Warp Speed.
I
understand a little more. Brandon, you have to give me an answer on this because I'm holding on by a thread. Why can no politician talk or communicate? Why would it be, guys, you know, President or Vice President Pence did an hour and 45 minutes, I think, today, or an hour and a half. Why couldn't it be, guys, let me give you a few details about Warp Speed. I want to show you and tell you about where your money's going.
Here's where the funding has gone.
Here's why we had to do this.
Here's what we've been able to accomplish. Here's what would have suffered if we didn't have the funding. Here's what we were able to do with it that wouldn't have happened on its own without our involvement, without our dollars. Yeah, I mean, that shouldn't be that hard. I mean, right? I mean, you could, that's like bullet points.
Well, treat me like you're talking to an adult.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you why we did this, how we did this, why a big company like Pfizer, why we had to incentivize them to do this.
Well, it's all about transparency, right? When you don't have that transparency, you don't feel confident. I mean, that's where distrust happens because we don't know what's going on behind the scenes.
I feel the whole world is getting stupider and trying to drag me down with it.
Yeah.
I feel like
nobody can talk and explain anything anymore. I mean,
I think the whole world's saying, why don't we just be stupid? Do we have to think? Why don't we just be dumb? And I think we're just holding hands and just saying, cool, we can do that. Seems like the easiest thing to do right now.
Yeah.
I think we're almost at an hour.
Disappointing.
We're using some new software and I really don't know how to read this thing. So I think we're coming up to an hour.
It seems
also,
like it.
We're also, you know, I can see both of our voices now. So I'm going to make a prediction that this might be a better sounding podcast from us. But,
oh, good.
But there's an 80% chance I'll screw this up at the end and it won't make any difference at all.
Hopefully not. As long as you don't delete the entire thing.
The first thing we're going to do is save it. So at least we have a raw sound file. So if I screw the pooch somewhere, we at least have that. I guess as we wrap this up, I don't expect anything on this to come to conclusion before first week of December. It literally feel like Trump is going to make an escalation point next week when he starts having people to the White House and actively lobbying states to overturn elections. And if we get into that part, I don't know what we do.
I don't either. Georgia's off the table because they certify tomorrow. So that's not going to be in contention. But yeah, I mean, he's bringing Michigan lawmakers tomorrow. So it'll be interesting to see what they say that he says and what comes out of that. You know, the others. But again, this is dangerous territory. It's very concerning. But even if these lawmakers were to somehow go against the people and put their electoral fortunes on the line, you still have Democratic governors in these states, which really throw a wrench into this whole idea that this would be possible.
Brandon, if a state overturns through the Electoral College, I think we'll do our first two men in the middle from the road as we roll to Washington to participate in a protest.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I think that would be the largest protest we've seen in this country.
If that happens,
I mean, that's the end of democracy as we know it.
If that happens, and I keep hearing some of the rational right pundits say, hey, he really hasn't crossed this line yet. You know, he's just farting around in the courts. Hey, his hobby is suing people. This will pass. You know, the institutions will hold.
But the fact that he's even contemplating this, and we know that several times he's asked his advisors about this as a possibility. I mean, that tells you that nothing seems to be off limits to him.
Yes.
I can't think of a past president that would have contemplated this.
No, I can't think of who's the worst president you remember.
Oh, of all time, like.
Well, in your lifetime, I mean,
in my lifetime, I don't know.
There was Bush.
Yeah,
people didn't like him, but he was just a conservative. That's what people didn't like. Bush the second.
I mean, that's wrong. There isn't for my lifetime. There's nobody to really compare him directly to.
I wouldn't really bag on anybody. Bush the second got into an impossible situation that I don't know. I don't know if Gore would have done any better, any different. So
No, and I know a lot of Democrats who were very anti-Bush, but now, in hindsight, you know, they look upon Bush with much more favorability than they did before. So it's all
I'd love to perspective. I'd love to have that old warmonger back in the office right now. At least with Bush, at least with most Republican presidents, you knew what you got. You may not like it, but you knew there was a bedrock that you knew this is where
Maybe
they were
we
making
need another
decisions
statement
from
President Bush. You know, days after the election, President Bush did release a statement where he congratulated President-elect Joe Biden, said he was an honorable man and that the election was conducted with integrity, that there wasn't any fraud. So that was intentional. You know, he was trying to send a message about where we were. But I mean, if Trump pursues this strategy with state lawmakers, I mean, this might be another incident where we need all of the living presidents to release a joint statement saying this is a bridge too far. We cannot do this.
And again, statements are nice, but as we've learned, they just don't do a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I am shocked at how much of the Constitution is literally on your honor.
Well, and you have people who support Trump who now view any opposition to Trump as traitorous. I mean, that's the terminology they use. And you have Republican voters who now look at George W. Bush and people like Mitt Romney as traitors because they do not go along with Trump. So we're just in very weird territory. I mean, there's no
And it comparison. feels like Q was just a warm up for this.
Yeah.
That Q was just a way to get conspiracy theory kind of
in the mainstream.
And then we're going to bait and switch you. It's not the Q one we want you. Now we want you to focus on this global Democrat Soros Clinton Foundation. Ugh,
that's exhausting.
I'm trying to think for money, for fame, for power. Would you get up in front of a mic and basically try to rip apart the constitutional democracy of the country?
I wouldn't, but because apparently there's enough people out there that would.
And for what?
Put their integrity on the line and their morals and ethics.
This is why I was asked people too.
Does nobody think about legacy anymore?
And this is all for Trump, that guy.
For one man.
And that's the man. That guy. This isn't Lincoln, for God's sakes. That's not Washington. You're selling your soul and your for that.
I don't understand it. I never will.
I don't get it. I don't feel like talking about anything tonight. It's just too much.
Are you
staying around for Thanksgiving?
I am staying in town, not going out anywhere, so it'll be quiet.
That's probably the best. All right, that's our hour. Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks for listening to 2 Men in the Middle. Make sure to give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Check out our website at 2meninthemiddle.com. Drop us an email at 2meninthemiddle@gmail.com or tweet at us at 2meninthemiddle. We'll see you next week.